watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. According to a Reuters report published Friday, greenhouse gases have hit a new record in the atmosphere, and the buildup is accelerating, apparently because of industrial growth in Asia. China is opening coal-fired power plants at the rate of almost one a week. Levels are at a new high, said Kim Holman, research director of the Norwegian Polar Institute, which oversees the Zeppelin measuring station on the Arctic archipelago of Svalbard, about 750 miles from the North Pole. Concentrations of carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas emitted largely by burning fossil fuels in power plants, factories, and cars, has risen to 390 parts per million, up from 388 just a year ago. 400 parts per million is considered the critical threshold beyond which warming effects may be on the point of no return. At the present rate of increase, we will reach the critical level in 5 years. Meanwhile, on Friday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at an all-time high. There is actually a relationship between the CO2 numbers and the Dow Jones numbers. Governments are maintaining the Dow Jones numbers, which reflect a toxic brew of overproduction and excessive consumption, all fueled by the burning of hydrocarbons, at the expense of focusing on the CO2 numbers and the capacity of our planet to sustain our sort of life form. 25% of the harmful emissions are coming from the United States, whose government has steadfastly refused to address the problem. We need immediate, comprehensive action on a global scale, and the efforts of conscientious individuals to lower our personal ecological footprints are not getting us far enough, fast enough, says our first speaker this week, George Monbiot. He says a mass movement that forces government action is necessary. George Monbiot's recent book, Heat, set out to create a realistic plan of action to tackle the drastic reduction of carbon emissions necessary to prevent runaway warming. His specific proposals are tailored to the UK and Europe more broadly, but they provide a template that could be tailored for use in the US. We'll begin with hearing a talk he gave a few months ago at a London bookshop, which comes to us thanks to our friends at the London Sound Posse.
One of the problems with climate change is that it stretches our imagination to breaking point. First, we have to accept that through our infinitesimal, minuscule actions, we are doing what all prior generations have dreamt of doing. In the past, people have danced for rain or prayed for the winter to end, but without much hope of success. And now we do it without even trying. And the idea that us, these tiny little specks on the scuzz on top of the planet, are able to exert an effect which sweeps across the entire atmosphere is almost incomprehensible. Then we have to accept that the actions which are causing this problem are actions which hitherto have been considered either entirely innocent or positively beneficial. making a cup of tea for the next door neighbours, picking up your kids from school, flying to New York for your brother's wedding. Under the old pre-climate change moral code, all those were good things. Morally good things. Under the new moral code demanded by climate change, they're also bad ones. And we find that what climate change does is to present us with the spectacle of two valid moral codes in irreconcilable antagonism. When you look at that last example of flying over to your brother's wedding in New York, you see an instance of what could be the most intractable of all causes of climate change, the phenomenon I call love miles. Love miles are the distance between yourself and the people you love. To redeem those love miles, you must travel. And that travelling is the fastest growing cause of environmental destruction. We see in this phenomenon that the planet could be destroyed by love, not something we were forced to contemplate before. But perhaps most mind-blowing of all, hardest of all to grasp, the thing which challenges our imagination more than anything else, is the idea that we, these minuscule, puny, ridiculous bipeds, can actually turn this thing around and can start to change our behavior in such a way that we influence the pattern of the entire global atmosphere for the good rather than for ill. And this is such a hard thing to grasp that it strikes me that even within the environmental movement, few dare to believe it. What I've seen over the past year has been an extraordinary and rather frightening phenomenon that the great majority of people whom I've met and talked to about climate change, about a year ago would say, well, yes, that does sound fairly serious, but is it really such a big deal? Do we really have to do anything about it? I mean, you know, it's one of these environmental problems which come up every so often, and surely it's not nearly as bad as people say it is. And that has switched almost imperceptibly and without any transitional phase at all to a position of equal moral abnegation, which is to say, it's too late, we can't do anything about it. Nowhere in between has anyone said, hey, this is a huge problem, it has to be stopped and we're going to act to stop it. Well, very few people have, but the majority of people who have taken an interest in it have gone from the sort of hopelessness of not acknowledging the seriousness of the situation to the hopelessness of acknowledging it to such an extent they believe they can't do anything about it. And what I set out to demonstrate in HEAT and in this talk is that it is not too late, not yet, not quite, that there is still a chance of turning this around, that even with our puny human bipedal resources, we can change the climate for the better, and we can avert what could otherwise become the greatest catastrophe that humanity has ever seen. Now, that sounds like a wild statement, the greatest catastrophe that humanity has ever seen, and it's the sort of statement which the right-wing newspapers love to jump up and down all over. But the right-wing newspapers are run by people, well, in fact, all the newspapers are run by people who have no understanding of science whatsoever. I went to a meeting of some very senior journalists, 150 of them, some of the top journalists from all over Europe. And the guy who was running it, chairing it, John Snow, asked us to put up our hands if we had a science degree. And out of 150, three of us put our hands up. And that to me explained a great deal of what I've been reading recently and hearing recently and watching recently, that a lot of the people in the key decision-making positions simply don't understand what they're looking at. They do not understand the difference between peer-reviewed research published in a proper peer-reviewed academic journal and figures made up on the back of an envelope by some bloke sponsored by Exxon. They do not understand the difference between a systematic review of the literature and cherry picking, where you just go through finding the data which suits your case and ignore all the rest of it. And as a result, we see unconscionable volumes of nonsense published on an almost daily basis throughout the media. But what the science says is that climate change has the capacity, the potential, to make all previous crises look like sideshows at the circus of human suffering. Wars, acts of genocide, famines, plagues. We haven't seen anything yet by comparison to some of the possible predictions which have been made. In last month's edition of the Journal of Hydrometeorology, I'm sure you've already read it, there's a paper which shows that, well, for the first time, it manages to strike what seems to be a clear prediction of the level of wetting and drying across the global atmosphere over the next 100 years. It's been a controversial matter for some time because as the atmosphere heats, there's an increased rate of evaporation from the ground, which would be expected to dry the ground, but that increased rate of evaporation also means there's an increased rate of rainfall. And there's been a lot of dispute about what the balance is. Well, scientists at the Met Office, for the first time, have published a comprehensive model incorporating all the latest data, which suggests there's going to be a severe global drying by 2100. And what this suggests, in particular, is a drying of continental interiors, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and many parts of Asia. Although that bit is not yet quite certain. That, if that is the case, combined with some of the other effects that we already know about, for instance, the inundation of coastal arable land by the sea, the salination of coastal aquifers, in other words, salt water as the sea level rises, creeping into your freshwater underground water supplies and contaminating them and making them useless for growing plants or indeed for drinking water, when we see those in combination with several other effects, plus rising human population levels, we have a formula for a net food deficit at the global level. In other words, even when you have a harvest which is in line with expectations under that model, there will not be enough food to go round. It's beyond my powers of description to try to explain what a world of 9 billion people in net food deficit would look like. But I'll leave it to your imagination. Now, that's not the only outcome which has been proposed. There was some correspondent of mine sent me an email which went as follows. Dear Mr. Monbiot, thank you for writing in The Guardian about climate change. It really is an extremely serious issue. If action isn't taken soon, the entire planet will turn into a desert. Well, I investigated this possibility and I regret to say that it's unfounded. The science does not support it, but the thought of baked Alaska and floating islands did come to mind. Barring that possibility, we clearly have a direct moral cause, a moral imperative to act on this. Perhaps a moral imperative greater than that we've ever faced before. If you're concerned about any development issue, whether it's hunger, whether it's access to fresh water, whether it's disease, you must also be concerned about climate change. We heard so much last year, and strangely almost nothing at all this year, about the Millennium Development Goals, which were going to make sure that no one went without education, no one went without fresh water, no one went without adequate nutrition, etc., etc. Those goals, which won't incidentally be met anyway because of a lack of funding by the G8 nations who made such great play of their generosity last year, those goals are not completely out of play if climate change is allowed to let rip. Now, the first thing I do in this book is to try to work out what level of cuts are necessary to prevent that catastrophe from taking place. What almost all climate scientists are now agreed on is that 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, and a global average warming of 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, is the point at which many of the worst impacts of climate change begin. One, the direct impacts, including the global drying, and we already knew before this latest paper that at about 2 degrees of warming, some 2 billion extra people are subjected to serious water stress, and major ecological impacts. For instance, it means the killing of every tropical coral reef on Earth, almost certainly the complete dieback of the Amazon, which is very close to what's called its critical resiliency threshold, in other words, very close to the point at which it just keels over because it becomes too hot, and the complete melting of the Arctic ice. Also, the possible triggering of the irreversible melting of the Greenland ice cap and the West Antarctic ice cap, both of which have the capacity to raise sea levels by anything up to 7 meters or so. But on top of all those direct effects, you have perhaps even more serious indirect effects. And this is the capacity of a temperature increase of that size to trigger off more climate change. In other words, to start what are known as positive feedback loops, climate change causing climate change. A classic example of this is the West Siberian peat bog. The West Siberian peat bog contains methane in very large quantities. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, about 23 times as powerful as carbon dioxide. And it contains as much greenhouse gas as humanity emits. It contains 73 times as much greenhouse gas as all of humanity emits in 1 year. At the moment, that methane stays where it is. And it does so because it's locked up in permafrost. But of course, as the permafrost begins to melt, the methane's released. The more methane is released, the more permafrost melts, the more methane is released, and so it goes on. And there are many other examples of this so-called positive feedback. In other words, if we get to 2 degrees, 3 degrees becomes an inevitability. If we get to 3 degrees, 4 degrees becomes an inevitability. Beyond 2 degrees, in other words, it's out of our hands. There is nothing more that we can do. And at that point, we might as well give up, eat, drink, and be merry, because there's absolutely no point in trying to affect climate change when those positive feedbacks have begun. So we have to prevent them from beginning. And that means that we have to act now. But act to what degree? Well, when you look at the probabilities associated with certain volumes of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you find that trying to hold temperatures down to 2 degrees or below corresponds roughly to a maximum, if you've got a high chance of preventing that from happening, you want a maximum stable concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of about 400 parts per million. Now, we started in pre-industrial times with 280. We've now reached 380. We're almost all of the way there. But it doesn't mean that we have to prevent it from getting to 400. We can let it overshoot a bit, but then we have to bring it down to 400 in pretty sharp order. And we have to do so according to the probability analysis associated with volumes of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by 2030. Now, by 2030, at the same time as all this other stuff is going on, the ability of the biosphere, which is the totality of the world's ecosystems, to absorb carbon dioxide declines quite rapidly. At the moment, humans produce about 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year, and the biosphere absorbs 4 billion tons. By 2030, that declines to 2.7 billion. And that's for all sorts of reasons, including things like the dieback of tropical forests and the soil beginning to produce more carbon dioxide than it absorbs as the metabolic rate of the bacteria that the soil contains rises with temperature. And so what we see is that the ability of the world to absorb our pollution reduces just as the pollution is increasing as a result of the pollution. At the same time, as I've already mentioned, human population is going to keep rising, and UN estimates suggest by the middle of the century about 9 billion people. Put all this together and you see that if you were to divide the amount of carbon we could sustainably produce in 2030 by the number of people expected to be on Earth in 2030, we find that our sustainable allocation is 0.33 tonnes of carbon. That means a 60% per capita cut worldwide between now and 2030. If that's to be allocated equally according to the principles of what's called contraction and convergence, that means in the rich nations, on average, a 90% cut in carbon emissions by 2030. That's what we need in order to prevent runaway climate change. Now, this sounds like a tall order, this sounds like a ridiculous proposal. But I think what I've demonstrated is that it is technologically and economically feasible. What I've done is to look step by step at all the major sectors of the economy, major in terms of their carbon emissions, to see how that 90% cut can be achieved without bringing industrial civilization tumbling down. Now, this isn't because I'm a particular fan of industrial civilization, but because it cannot work politically any other way. If I were to stand up here and advocate a return to agricultural society, for example, which I don't think I would do anyway, but if I were to do that, it would be pure self-indulgence, because I might find that I managed to persuade about 100 people in the United Kingdom that that was a good idea. If this is to carry political weight, if this is to work, I have to show that it's viable in terms which people are prepared to accept. In other words, that their basic comforts and basic prosperity will be retained, that they will be able to lead lives which continue to give them the sort of satisfaction which lives give them today. There will have to be some changes, but what I've tried to do throughout is to minimise the pain involved. Now, environmentalists quite often like pain, but pain doesn't work very well politically, so we've got to try to avoid it. So I've started with the housing sector. I'm just running ahead of myself. First of all, we've got to have a framework to try to make the entire system that I'm going to talk about work. And that framework ideally should be one which encourages enthusiasm for cutting carbon emissions rather than just making people resentful. And the problem with the carbon taxation that we've heard a great deal about over the past few weeks is that A, as we've seen, it makes people resentful, but B, unless it's handled very, very carefully, it can be extremely unfair. And if it's done crudely, the obvious result is that the rich carry on using as much energy and as much carbon as they want, while the poor have massively to cut back on their consumption. And it can be extremely regressive in its impacts. To make sure it's not regressive, you have to install a very complex system if it's to be matched to a reducing carbon cap, which comes down by a certain percentage every year. And one of the lessons of politics is that complexity doesn't work well. It always gets misinterpreted. I mean, these carbon taxes have been misinterpreted even before they've been properly mooted. It seems to me that a much better idea, both in terms of its political effectiveness and in terms of its equity, is the idea first proposed by Mayor Hillman back in 1990, which is that of carbon rationing. At its core, it's a very simple idea. It says you take the total amount of carbon dioxide which the economy uses, you then identify that portion which is used directly by you and I. In other words, when we pay for our electricity and our gas bills, fill up our cars, buy plane or train tickets, about 40% of all the carbon dioxide, and then you divide that by the number of people in the country and you give everyone an equal right to use that amount of carbon dioxide, and that comes down every year according to the total cap that you've set on the economy. So it comes down by 90% between now and 2030. In doing so, you do two things. You first of all ensure that while the rich might continue to use more energy than the poor, they can only do so by giving a substantial amount of their income to the poor. Because the only way in which you can exceed your carbon ration under that system is to buy surplus from someone who's used less than their ration. And by and large, the poor, that's all studies right across the world show, use much less energy than the rich. And so you'll see an automatic transfer of wealth from the rich to the poor taking place. At the same time, it encourages an enthusiasm for carbon saving. People are going to want to keep the lights on. They're going to want to keep their houses heated. They're going to want to keep travelling. So this will stimulate a great demand for low carbon technologies. People will be saying to their energy companies, look, don't give me electricity coming from fossil fuel burning power stations, because I won't be able to keep within my carbon budget and keep all the lights on if you do that. And you'll see that a virtuous circle developing as the demand drives further demand. The other 60%, incidentally, unlike the system under the European Emissions Trading Scheme, which is grossly unfair, the other 60% is auctioned off to the companies who use energy on our behalf. And so it gets incorporated into the price of their products. The Emissions Trading Scheme, incidentally, gave away huge pollution rights to the biggest polluters. The polluters got paid, in other words, and it was a straightforward classical act of enclosure. The right to pollute, or the right to have a proportion of the sustainable amount of carbon dioxide the economy produces, was taken away from us and given to them before a shot was even fired. And this was sort of stolen from us without any discussion taking place at all in a democratic sense. So we've got this system, this carbon rationing system, which, if it were imposed today without any further government measures, and that cap brought down and down and down to 90% of what it is still, 10% of what it is today by 2030, it would be a disastrous and grossly unfair scheme, because we simply wouldn't be able to keep our homes lit and heated, and we wouldn't be able to travel around. We would find that what we take to be our quality of life pretty well came to a grinding halt, because without further government measures to supplement that, our infrastructure is simply incapable of delivering those low carbon solutions. So let's start with the domestic sector, with our houses, and indeed with buildings in general. And we see here that we have a collective ecological disaster, particularly in the United Kingdom, whose housing stock is the oldest and the worst in Western Europe, and is in a really, really terrible state of repair. We just put no priority whatsoever on energy saving. Let me give you a couple of examples. So there are 17 million houses in this country which have got cavity walls. And you think, well, that's got to be a good thing. Only 6 million of them have cavity wall insulation. So there are 11 million homes which you could, for almost no money, it's so cheap, you just stuff a bit of foam into the wall and boom, you've got a much more energy efficient house. 11 million people, the great majority of people with cavity walls, haven't had them filled. And there are various reasons for this, but the biggest part is that we don't care enough, and that energy is so cheap at the moment, the heating is so cheap that people have just been able to squander it. But another major part is that landlords have got no incentive whatsoever to help their tenants save energy, because it's the tenants who have to carry the energy bills, and the landlords have no pressure on them to cut those tenants' bills. 10% of homes in this country have no insulation whatsoever. Absolutely nothing, anywhere. And then a very large number of houses, probably 2 to 3 million out of our stock of 25.5 million, are probably beyond effective repair as far as insulation and preventing all the air from escaping is concerned. And possibly the only answer for them is demolition and rebuilding, which of course has its own carbon costs. So it's not going to be easy. And when you look at the sector as a whole, you find that you could probably, even with quite strict regulations and with carbon rationing, only get about a 30 to 40% cut in energy terms by 2030. So obviously, just energy efficiency alone is not going to be enough. But there are various ways in which it can be quite effectively accelerated. One of them is much, much stricter building regulations and stricter enforcement of those regulations. And at the moment, our builders have been able to get away with murder. We have in Britain energy efficiency regulations in 2006, which are worse than those in Sweden in 1978. And it doesn't stop there. The problem is that even those pathetic regulations are completely unenforced. They've been enforced since 1985, or various energy efficiency regulations have, and since that time, there hasn't been a single prosecution for non-compliance anywhere in the United Kingdom. Is this because all our builders are whiter than the driven snow and have never caused any problems as far as meeting energy efficiency regulations go? The hell it is. The Building Research Establishment surveyed a whole load, thousands of new homes, found that 60% of them should have been failed on energy efficiency regulations. They found that some of them had the requisite amount of insulation in the lofts, but it was still tied up in bales because there'd been no incentive for anyone to roll it out. And it goes on and on and on. It's just a complete disaster. There are now houses in Germany, there's 4,000 of them, there are several thousand elsewhere in the world, which, though scarcely more expensive than ordinary houses that we build today, require no heating systems, none whatsoever. All the heat they get comes through windows, which are very nicely made and sized exactly to the size of the house, to the volume of the house, and the body heat of the people who live in them. And yet they maintain, in the very harsh German winter, a constant temperature of 19 degrees. And they do so simply through good building. They make sure that the thermal envelope of the house, in other words, the bit which keeps the heat in, or is supposed to keep the heat in, is intact. In other words, there are no what are called thermal bridges, no conducting material going from the inside of the house to the outside of the house, taking that heat away. They're properly sealed, and the air comes in and goes out through heat exchangers, so that the warm air going out heats the cold air coming in. And you don't need a heating system at all. It seems miraculous, especially when you realise that they only cost 7% more than ordinary homes. But it's simply about having those homes built properly and properly enforced and properly inspected. And who is this bad for? You know, everyone goes on about how regulations is awful burden on the citizen. It's not, it's just a burden on the construction companies, which is why it's not happening, which is why we haven't seen the sort of regulation we need. But once you've got that house built, it's good for everyone who lives in it. It keeps your bills down, and it's a much cosier and more comfortable place in which to live. But I would also like to see much tougher building regulations imposed whenever there's a major refurbishment of a house, for the same reasons. I mean, at the moment, like in my own house, the previous bloke did this massive refurbishment, and it all looks great, and underneath it there's sort of gaps in the insulation like this, and it's a total ecological disaster, like just about everybody's house. And it would cost me a fortune to rip it all down and start all over again, whereas it would have cost him 500 or 1,000 quid, and he would have halved my gas bills. When this proposal was put to the housing minister, Yvette Cooper, she dismissed it on the grounds that it would be unnecessary gold plating. I remember that every time I read my gas bill. and then with landlords, it seems to me that just as there are currently fire regulations which they have to meet before they rent out a house, where you have to have proper fire doors and fire escapes and the rest of it, why should they not also be subject to energy efficiency regulations? Why shouldn't it be the case that before a landlord rents out a house, it has to meet certain energy standards? And again, it's good for everyone. It's not just the climate that's benefiting, it benefits the tenants as well. But even so, even with all those measures and plenty more besides, and really powerful measures to try to increase the energy efficiency of all the gadgets and the gizmos, the light bulbs and the fridges and the washing machines, which is all quite pathetic at the moment, even if all those are introduced, it's probably 30 or 40% of the maximum energy efficiency saving we're going to get in that very short time frame. So we have to find ways of decarbonising the supply of the remaining energy that we use. And when it comes to electricity, this is actually relatively easy, certainly by comparison to some of the other schemes which I'm going to be talking about. Because there are lots of ways of making electricity, and quite a few of them involve quite low carbon routes. We've all become very fixated by nuclear power. And if nuclear power was a way of making heat, I might be slightly more inclined towards it, because heat's a very difficult thing to generate in sufficient quantities with low enough carbon. But as a means of generating electricity, well, it's almost an irrelevant debate because there are so many other ways of doing it. My objection to nuclear, incidentally, is principally the following, that since the Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed in 1968, every nation which has sought or succeeded in becoming a nuclear weapons state has done so by diverting resources from its civil nuclear program. And anyone who wants to see a world without nuclear weapons should also want to see a world without nuclear power, because you can't have the one without the other. Anyway, so electricity. Well, there are several proposals, but I'm going to talk about just one of them, which is tapping into very high value sources of ambient energy. At the moment, the Greens in general have become rather obsessed by the idea of microgeneration, of sticking one of these wind turbines you can now buy at a knockdown price from B&Q on your roof, or solar panels and the rest of it. And I think this is a disaster for a couple of reasons. For a start, most of these technologies have been wildly overrated, grossly exaggerated in their effects. B&Q claims that its WindSave 1000 micro turbine, which you stick on a rooftop, will cut the average household's electricity bills by 30%. Bill Dunster of BedZ claims the same turbine will cut them by 50%. I'm going to be putting in a complaint to the Advertising Standards Authority, because in both cases it is total nonsense. Building for a Future magazine did an analysis of that wind turbine and found it's more like 5%. That's the average cut in your electricity bills for the average household across the country that you'll get from one of those wind turbines. To get up to 50%, you'd have to go up from having a 1.75 metre turbine, which is what they're talking about, to a 4 metre turbine. And if you stick one of those in the gable end of your house, it'll rip it off. The whole thing will just shatter because of the lateral thrust exerted by the wind. And it just doesn't make any sense. And the reason you get so little yield from them is that we've chosen to live in places which aren't very windy, for obvious reasons. And it's almost going to sort of find the most sheltered places of all and sticking your wind turbines there. I think we ought to be going in exactly the opposite direction. You go to the places where there's a huge amount of energy and you build your turbines on a massive scale, you go as big as possible, and then you find the cheapest and most effective means of transmitting that energy to where it's needed. And my two main proposals both sound completely mad, but they do seem to be plausible when you look at them a bit harder. And the first one is to start making use of huge areas of the continental shelf well offshore, and building wind turbines of up to 10 megawatts capacity. I mean, really enormous monster turbines. So far offshore that the only people whose aesthetic sensibilities would be upset are trawlermen. Outside all the problems of migrating birds and all the rest of it, I mean, way, way out. And connected to the grid, and this has been the big problem up till now, not with your standard electricity conducting cables, your high voltage alternating current cables, but with high voltage direct current cables, whose use has been very limited by technological difficulties up till now, but now with extruded polyethylene cables and high voltage valves and all sorts of new technologies, it's possible to run them across 4,500 kilometres and still keep that transmission economic. The reason is that very high voltage DC, we're talking 600,000 volts, loses far less electricity in transmission than alternating current does. And also you can get much, much lighter systems, which means that it's much cheaper, takes up much less land as well. You don't get these enormous pylons of the sort that you get nowadays with alternating current and all the rest of it. And that means that you can start making use of really far-flung resources. The great thing about the continental shelf, and going right out there, is that you've got much more reliable winds, much stronger winds, and a much wider area to start exploiting. And the wider the area you use, the more reliable your electricity becomes. And one of the big problems of renewables is their intermittency. The wind stops, but the demand for electricity doesn't. But if you have some way out in the North Sea, way out towards on the continental shelf on the Atlantic side, way out in the Channel and all the rest of it, then the chances that there'll be no wind blowing in any no wind blowing in all of those places become very low indeed. But an even more reliable system, and this really does sound crazy, but high voltage direct current cables make it possible, lies to the south of Europe, and it's the Sahara. And this has been mooted before by a few rogue environmentalists, and they've been dismissed as nutters, but it now is beginning to look feasible. And this is to look at the possibility of building very large scale solar thermal electricity plants dotted right across the Sahara. Here we have another possibility of wealth transfer from the rich to the poor, as these very poor North African nations and Saharan nations can start exporting large quantities of electricity to Europe. But we also have two very exciting properties which aren't found as far as most renewable resources are concerned. Number one, that it is reliable as far as the predictability of the sun is concerned. You know that the sun is going to come up, it's going to be pretty strong, that there's a very low likelihood of there being clouds. The second thing is that the Sahara runs from east to west. And this means that when the sun's going down on one end of the Sahara, it's coming up at the other. And you get about 15 hours of rock-solid electricity covering the entire period of European peak demand. Now you start feeding that into a European supergrid. I know this is all sounding ridiculously techy and industrial, but I'm afraid this is the scale on which we had to start thinking. You start feeding that into a European supergrid, and you see that we can start to crack this issue of electricity without even having to look at a fossil fuel or even having to look at nuclear power. When you start looking at some of the new possible energy storage technologies, it gets even more exciting and firms up even more. Am I? Oh, blimey, 5 minutes. Right. Okay. All right. Okay. I'll stick electricity on one side. Talk very briefly about heat. Not the issue heat, warmth. And here we find a much bigger problem, really, because about 82% of the energy we use in our homes takes the form of heat rather than electricity. And the renewable supplies to produce even the reduced amount after we got that 40% cut in our domestic energy consumption simply isn't there at the moment. Even if you use all the solar thermal panels and ground-sourced heat pumps and biomass available in this country, even if we plant a lot more biomass, we still fall quite a long way short of what the demand is likely to be. So we have to find new and innovative means of generating it, and here I come to my least satisfactory proposals, because the only thing I can find at the moment which is going to fill that gap is hydrogen. Now, hydrogen's been used as a fuel for a long time. It was a major component of town gas, and so we used to burn it to keep warm and to provide lighting in the past. And it can be piped over long distances, but it requires a whole new pipeline network. It can be manufactured through the cracking of natural gas and the capture of the carbon dioxide which is produced from that cracking, and that gets piped away and can be buried. Another major technological issue, but again, it seems that according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, at any rate, you've got a very high chance that 99% of the carbon dioxide you'd bury in an old gas aquifer would still be there in 1,000 years' time, which is good enough for me. But it's still, we're talking about really difficult, tricky, technological stuff. And a huge new hydrogen pipeline network covering the whole country and basically replacing the natural gas network within 24 years. We're at the very limits of feasibility here, even if you look at it purely in technological and economic terms. So I'm not happy with the proposal, but I'm still waiting for someone to come up with a better one. Okay, because I've got so little time and I've talked far too long about electricity and stuff, just very briefly about transport, and for a start about surface transport. And here we've got almost the opposite problem to the heat problem, in that it's incredibly easy technologically and economically to get a 90% cut in carbon even while retaining high levels of mobility. But the difficulty comes, well, I suppose it can be summarized in two words, Jeremy Clarkson. It's this attitude that I can do what the hell I like on the road. I can drive whatever car I want, I can drive it how I want. If I want to drive it down the pavement and mow you all down, I'll do that as well. And anyone who gets in my way is a lycra-wearing Nazi sandalista from Islington. And so we have this massive cultural barrier to what could be some ideas which are really, by comparison to anything else that I propose, really very easy to implement. For instance, we know at the moment that the electric car works, that there are plenty of electric cars around and they've been working for a very long time, but the basic problem with them is that the electricity runs out after 100 miles or so. And then you have to plug it in and wait for hours and hours until it recharges. And this, for unaccountable reasons, is a bit of a disincentive to having an electric car. But the whole model of making use of those cars is just completely wrong. And the model is based on owning your own battery. If instead you were to lease your battery, and you had a network of filling stations which basically leased you a battery as you went along, the problem is solved. You pull into your filling station, someone opens the boot, the crane comes over, pulls out the old battery, sticks in a new one, and off you go. Takes no more time than filling up your car with petrol. Where's the great difficulty? Where's the need for this incredibly elaborate program for making hydrogen cars? Where's the need for this incredibly destructive program to replace fossil fuel with biofuel, causing far more global warming and far more problems than even fossil fuels are causing? There's no need for it at all. There's a very, very simple way of doing it. The electricity would come from those massive wind turbines I've been talking about, which keep turning at night, even when we're all in bed and using very little. And you use what is basically free and carbon-free electricity to prime those batteries at night, and then, bang, they're plugged into the cars during the day and they're off. But, of course, being an environmentalist and realising all the other problems with cars, I want to see most people out of the cars, ideally. And there's another way of achieving a 90% cut, which is just as easy to achieve and even cheaper than that battery network. The bad news is that it revolves around the coach. And as most people will know who rely on coaches, it's a dismal and humiliating way of getting about at the moment. And it's dismal and humiliating because it's based on a completely stupid system. And it's a stupid system because it's a historical hangover from the time when coaches were pulled by horses and were generally faster than they are today. The basic problem is that the coach stations are in the city centres. An economist called Alan Storkey has looked at this problem and says, shut down the coach stations in the city centres and move them to the junctions of the motorways. Then you extend your urban public transport networks out to meet those junctions. In doing so, you revitalise your urban public transport because it starts serving the suburbs properly with much more regular services than before and goes all the way out. The coaches never leave the motorways. They just go up and down the motorways all the time in dedicated coach lanes. So they can basically overtake the rest of the traffic on the inside. And because every coach hoovers up a mile of cars in terms of the people it carries, you open up, you free up a huge amount of space for those coaches to use without any new infrastructural costs. This is the advantage over building railways, for example. And the coaches have priority at the intersections. When you put the whole system together, you see that the total journey is about the same amount of time, a journey of 100 miles or more, as it would take in a car, and rather more convenient, because you can go to sleep and use your mobile phone and all the things you do in your car anyway, but you can do it legally. And it's not hard to see how that could be explained as an actual advantage to people, that this could be seen as an improvement in our quality of life, potentially. At the same time, there has to be a shutting down of road space, much of the road space used by the private car today. When it comes to aviation, however, it's very hard to sell this. I really am just coming to the end. It's very hard to sell my proposals for aviation as something which people will embrace with open arms, because the basic problem is that getting a plane into the air and keeping it there is quite a difficult technological feat. And it takes place within a pretty narrow set of technological circumstances which are very hard to replicate. And within the time frame I'm talking about, 24 years, there is nothing on the horizon which is anywhere near replacing either the basic jet engine, the basic airframe, the body of the plane, or the basic fuel kerosene. And this is the fastest growing source of carbon emissions, the fastest growing source of greenhouse gas emissions in general, because the greenhouse gas emissions produced by planes are not confined to carbon, and it has the potential all by itself to cook the planet, to cause the catastrophic problems that I'm talking about. And it seems that unless we go to airships, which is one possibility I've had seriously to investigate, and it's not something which should be wholly dismissed, there is no other technological substitute. And the only option here is a 90% cut in the number of flights we take between now and 2030. In other words, to put it into exactly the opposite direction in which the government is pushing aviation. But that's, there are a few other proposals which I don't have time to talk about, but that aviation one is the only one which is going to be really painful. All the others can pretty well fit into life as we lead it. They don't require massive changes in the way that we go about our lives. And what I think I've done, I hope I've done, is in the book to show how all of these things are technologically and economically feasible. But what I have not done, and I've not even attempted to do, is to show that they are politically feasible. And there's a reason for that. The reason is that it's not up to me to show that it's politically feasible. It's up to you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to a talk by UK journalist George Monbiot, author of Heat. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. We continue with questions from the audience.
Let's open it up. Who would like to kick off with a question or a contribution? If you just raise your hand. Gentleman there, we'll take you afterwards. If you'd like to stand up and just so people can hear you. Thanks.
Hi, George. Mike, you ended very quickly with the political feasibility issue. It's up to you. It makes some time to elaborate on that, and my particular question was, can you react to the march on Saturday, your reactions to it, how you felt it went, and where it goes next?
Do you want to take a couple at a time, or one?
No, I'll take them one at a time.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Thanks very much for that, and thanks for the opportunity to carry on where I left off. Right, as I was saying...
Did you plan to?
What I'm calling for is the biggest mass movement we've ever seen. This is the only way this is going to happen. Because what we see from our politicians all the time is a sort of recognition that we want them to be seen to do the right thing without actually doing it. They I think, have correctly interpreted the public mood as being... wanting to feel good about ourselves without having to change anything, without having to see any of the potentially disruptive changes that I'm talking about. And so they're all at it. All the major parties can just happily sail by, saying all the right things, knowing full well that it'll be someone else's problem by the time these issues hit home. And somehow we've got to jolt that system and just force those people to pay attention to the fact that this is the overwhelming issue. And the only way to do that is to show numbers far, far greater than the numbers that we saw on Saturday. Now, those numbers are pretty impressive by comparison to what we've seen in previous years. Last year there were 8,000. I mean, this year there was between 15 and 20. Last year there was 8. The year before that there was about 1,000. And so it's growing at a tremendous rate, almost as fast as climate change, but it's still not nearly enough. We need to see much, much more mobilisation.
You'd like...
Great speech, and I was at the march, and I thought it was fantastic. I'm by no means a scientist. I'm an aviation buff. And I was looking at the turbine engine. Mm. And we have what they call a starter generator, which in effect starts the turbine. And when the turbine spins up, then switches to generating. Mm. And I'm sure a lot of people in the audience have had an idea they thought was genuinely their own. Mm. I had an idea, and I went to an inventor's website, and I thought, what about cars for this concept? Mm. You know, and it exists. General Motors have regenerative braking. I've been a bike courier along for nearly 10 years. Yeah. Yeah. I've done 500,000 miles, blah, 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 blah. I've worn my discs down. You know, the energy to do that is a lot, right? It's wasted energy, right? Mm. General Motors have heavy vehicles, and they've got a regenerative braking system. My point is the technology exists. Mm. We need the political will to implement it on a big scale. Mm. The financial incentives, you know what I mean? And we need to get a bit technical, and like you gave an example in Germany, Sweden, even America. These people are into this kind of technology that needs to be pushed. Sure. People aren't stupid. They can be made to understand that there is no, it's not a solution, but it will mitigate to a certain extent some of these problems that you face. Mm. And before I sit down, I'd like to say also, I've got a big bee in my bonnet about waste, rubbish. Mm. I've spoken to somebody in the industry, the caliber quality of plastics and stuff that we chuck away in landfill. It can, you know what I mean? Got a great lot of energy right there. Yeah. It's on the website today in Japan. They're working on it to get the dioxins out, etc., etc. Mm. That's something right there to look at.
Yeah, thanks. Yes, I find myself in a very odd position, standing up and calling for technological and economic measures, where for almost all the rest of my life I've been calling for political measures, and it does feel uncomfortable for a political activist like me to be saying what we need is this bizarre hydrogen pipeline network and high voltage DC cables and all the rest of it. But what I've found, and I'm sure what you've found as well, is that I've had to put those sort of quibbles to one side because we are faced with this emergency. This is a matter for emergency planning, and we have to throw everything at it. And I don't like constantly harking back to Second World War analogies, but you can't really help it, because there is a very powerful analogy there, isn't there? For instance, when the US joined the Second World War, the economy just turned around on a sixpence. It was extraordinary what happened. I mean, you had General Motors, which up till then was producing motor cars, within 90 days had designed, modelled, tested, and was mass-producing a fighter aircraft. I mean, it's extraordinary. Somehow they can always do it for killing people. It seems to be much harder for them to overcome that barrier of
technology. The Bush administration has declared this Orwellian state of long war to try and keep the masses. You know, I mean, why don't we just declare a global war? That's how it's war on climate change, and we can have a fight, a proper dichotomy, a true dichotomy between what's good for the planet, what isn't. Let's just go for it. Let's go for war, you know what I mean?
I wouldn't go down that route, because I'll take it literally. Any excuse. Whoa, that sounds like a good idea.
But you know what I mean.
Sure. No, of course I know exactly what you mean. And that's the way we've got to start thinking. We've got to see it as an emergency of the kind that we had in 1939.